if you expect good things, you get good things. And it's usually been my approach to include. So once again, I brought in people into the sort of management arena. The squadron commanders, and I'd bring specialists in, and I would involve them in the decision making.
Sorry, if you can continue.
The best way, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're in business or in sport or whatever, the only way to really ensure that your people perform to their best for the big match is to play lots of smaller matches, but nevertheless as hard as you possibly can. And the people who set the biggest challenges to you in that are very often the people who normally have to carry these things out. So I set up little teams of squadron leaders and said, right, you plan the exercises. And, you know, they would do the most Machiavellian bloody exercises, but because they knew where the warts were in the system because they'd been part of it. So they would test us in areas that we wouldn't normally have been tested in. For example, if command and group set up exercises, they were absolutely predictable because they had to do it on a sort of broad brush front, whereas we could actually do it by people who knew where the weaknesses were because they'd experienced it themselves, and you'd have to learn to work through that. So we got very smart at dealing with our deficiencies, which leads me back to the point that we had weaknesses in equipment and weaknesses in certain areas, but by sheer human intelligence and endeavour, you can actually overcome many of them. And we did. And that was hugely rewarding. The other aspect of life at Lucas was we were fortunate enough to be closest to where all the Russian aircraft used to come and deploy. And so we had many, many live scrambles, huge numbers of live scrambles, depending upon the political situation at the time, which was terrifically exciting for the young pilots, you know, that were to intercept your first Russian aircraft out over the North Sea, right up perhaps almost 1,000 miles away. It was a terrific challenge.
What is the range of these Phantoms then?
Well, normally, I mean, we used to operate them with quite a lot of tanks on, so you could probably operate them for all the tanks 3 hours. Right? You could probably do around 1,000 miles if you've got it up high, but we always had air-to-air refueling, so you'd get up there, plug into a tanker, and you'd be able to go on. So you could stay up for a long, long time, actually. And you could do 7-hour sorties if you wanted to. And, you know, that would take you a long way.
Yes. Mm. And when the Russians came over, did you ever... You obviously sometimes are up on some
I
of these
have
gambles,
intercepted Russians, yes.
You have?
Yes, yes.
When you have intercepted them, of course, it's inadvisable, I would have thought, to shoot them down because of the consequences that might flow. But their job, presumably, is to test you, to push you to the limit.
Yes.
And how do you respond to that without obviously being able to do what you're trained to do, which is to shoot an aircraft down? How do you get it to turn around?
Well, a very interesting question, and you're quite right. What they were doing in many... Well, some of them had perfectly legitimate reasons to be where they were doing. They were doing reconnaissance on fleet activities many times. So, you know, we just intercepted them, show that we could see where they were and to see what they were up to, see what sort of cameras they got. There was a lot of intelligence work down there. We had cameras so we could take pictures of them and see what their latest equipment was. They were taking pictures of us and all that. So there was that dimension to it. They would then send probes to see, and they'd come in at low level and see when we picked them up. So they were testing our defences. So we had to make sure that, you know, we were up there. And if we got some useful intelligence, very often we'd get early warning from people near the Kola Peninsula, and then we'd work out where we thought they'd come, and we'd send off tankers, we'd send off the fighters, and they'd be waiting for them there, and bang, they'd get them, which used to, you know, give them a bit of cause for concern. My God, how do they know we were here? All of that was sort of ongoing, but just occasionally, if they did want to be intercepted, and the most interesting parts of this was when they were when the Long Range Air Force was operating with the Russian submarines, and there was quite clearly a tie-up there, information being passed, whatever. And of course, if we could catch them doing that, intercept them, we could gain a huge amount of intelligence from it. And they didn't want us to do that. And they would do all sorts of things to stop us. One of the things they did was introduce sort of strobe lighting, which would flash at a frequency which you had to be very careful about, because it actually sends you a bit gaga if you get the frequency. Right? So you had to be aware of it and make sure you didn't get, you know, sucked in, or they would lead you down very close to the sea or something like that. Certainly they would try, if they didn't want to be intercepted. Most of the time they were quite happy to be intercepted because they wanted intelligence back. But if they didn't, they would literally try and shake you off. But there was never a risk, I didn't think, of... We never had a political situation when we would have shot down an aeroplane. I mean, the worst that would have happened, we'd have flown in front of them and told them to buzz off. We might have fired a shot across their bows with a cannon. But they knew the rules, and they'd come right in, right the way in, before they actually got into national waters as opposed to international waters, then they'd veer off. So we were never faced with that.
And did one final question on Lucas. I get the impression this was an extremely happy posting for you, and also I suggest a happy posting for everybody else who was up there.
Yes, I think so.
And were families allowed up, or were they dispersed around the UK, or were they allowed up there?
It was very, very... It's one of the joys of being in Scotland is whilst, you know, there are a lot of Scots who want to be there, there's a lot of people from all over the United Kingdom who had married quarters up there or lived in the community around there. More so than you get at many stations down in England, where people tend to live in their own homes more. So up there, people were unlikely to buy homes. Some did, the Scots, obviously. But most lived on the married quarters. So you had a very buoyant, lively community, which made for, you know, extremely good social occasions as well.
And contributed to the general well-being. And
very much so. A fundamental part of it is the family involvement.
The family, yes. And then I think you went somewhere quite interesting, possibly.
That's right. I went off to the Falklands. They shoved me off down to the Falklands. So I did just under 2 years up there, I think. And I was sent off straight off to the Falklands for the rest of the year. Initially, I was the senior RAF officer down there and station commander of Royal Air Force Stanley. And then halfway through my time, they decided that was too much for one guy to do, which was probably true. And so they sent another group captain down to do the staff job, and I stayed doing the RAF Stanley job. But it was a great challenge.
When did you get down?
I went down there in July to 1983, so just about a year or so after the conflict had ended, when we were still operating from a tin airfield, basically. Where the runway was metal planks. We had something like 10 Phantoms down there, and 4 Harriers, a couple of Hercules, lots of helicopters, lots of Rapier missiles, lots of RAF regiment, and of course the army had its own Rapier missiles and a number of battalions down there as well. We were all under the command of a two-star army, Commander of British Forces, General Keith Spacey, para. Nice man. Used to run everywhere. Fitness freak. Used to run from bloody Stanley to RAF Stanley, for God's sake. But he was a very nice man. It's a very, very lonely job down there. And it's a long, long way, as you're well aware. And getting down there was not easy, because it was, you know, what's called the Hercules Bridge, which had to be air-to-air refueled out of Ascension Island. And, you know, if the weather was dodgy halfway down, they wouldn't press on. They'd turn around and go back. Some of them landed in some pretty dicey weather, because the weather could change in the Falklands literally in minutes. You could have a situation where it was gin clear and suddenly the wind would swing and the airfield would go out. And that happened a couple of times when I was there. I mean, we were recalling airplanes and we had to literally land people on the other end of the runway, and they'd sort of disappear into fog halfway down it. The problem with the Phantom, which was the most difficult to operate from there, because the Harrier could always slow down and land on a pad, and the C-130 could always divert to Chile or somewhere. We'd always have enough fuel for that. The F-4, really, you had to land it with a hook. The runway was not really long enough, particularly if you were heavy. And we were heavy because we were carrying missiles and guns all the time. We were ready for war. Every aeroplane was armed, ready to go. The Falklands was still a war zone because the Argentinians had not, said it wasn't.
Yes.
And they used to test our defences regularly.
Did they?
Yes, they used to come punching across and fly right up to the area that we'd said don't, and then turn around and go back. And, we'd punch on out to try and intercept them. Well, we did.
And despite the fall of the junta?
Yes. I mean, yes, I suppose the junta, had it fallen or whether had they just changed? I can't remember. But whatever the regime was at the time, it was still not friendly. And I think there was still quite a strong autonomy in the armed forces. And they did send airplanes out every now and then to test.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm. And boats used to enter the area as well. And we had the Navy down there. There was usually a couple of frigates and submarines and things. It's quite a little, feast of capability. It really was.
So this is one active operational command in Lucas against the Russians to another?
Yes, to another.
Which may have been the reason for your appointment, do you think?
Well, they certainly always tried to take an operational station commander from UK and put him down there to run the base, and I think they were quite right to do that, because it was distinctly operational. I mean, our Beale and Elder, we worked 12 hours on, 12 hours off, 12 hours on, 12 hours off every day. It was that sort of thing. And the 12 hours on was usually more like 16, but that's it was at a minimum to do that, and it was a wonderful challenge to maintain morale. And of course, I've always believed, the tougher the environment with a good leadership, the better morale is. And it was quite tough. I was down there for most of the winter, which is pretty bleak down there. The old guards there going around. I mean, we were very worried about special forces or the equivalent coming in. It was our one Achilles heel, because there's just no way. There's so many islands, so many inlets, so much easy to get small boats onto it, that they could, if they had so wished, and it would have been quite a good bolster of morale back home, to have blown up a few things, bomb dumps and airplanes and what. So we had guards patrolling all night with dogs around the airfields, and going out and talking. I used to sleep down on the airfield, I think every second or third night. In my office, so that I was right on the spot. Everybody did that. That was the way it was done. And I think it was the right thing to do. You were down with the troops who were on duty all night. And talking to some of these young lads, out there walking with their dogs and doing that. They were up for it. Mm. They really were. And yet, walking in those bitter temperatures sometimes, lonely and whatever, their morale was still very, very high. Functioning, jolly good leadership, genuine job to do. And whilst, the physical comforts were limited, I think people bent over backwards, the chefs and whatever one could do to sort of ease people's tenure down there, was very, very well received.
And no families, of course, I assume.
No.
Only 2,500 islanders, or whatever the number was.
Yes, it was less than that.
Less than that, even, possibly. And, of course, much...
Absolutely, two or three times the numbers of servicemen. Yes, a very sort of tendentious situation. There were frictions, but I think by and large they were controlled. I didn't allow the troops down in Stanley Town very much at all. So the only they could go down there during the day on their off-duty time to certain places, but not go to the pubs and get pissed. If they wanted to get pissed, they could do that on the base, and they did. But that was it. Work them like hell, get them pissed, send them to bed, get up. Provided they weren't too pissed, and again that boiled down to good NCO supervision. Then that was fine. By and large, the relationships with the locals were managed predominantly. I'd say predominantly at officer level. I got to know a lot of them down there, but it's part of my job, going out to some of the houses on the camp, as it was called, meeting people. I had a lot of parties, drinks parties, where I brought them in. Like, by God, can they drink? The Falkland Islanders, they can smell a free drink from a million miles away, and they go for it. So we had some serious booze up there, because booze was incredibly cheap down there, so it really wasn't a hardship. And, it was all good for the sort of local relationships, and we all did that. And I think the relationships were as good as you can expect against the background of, overwhelming military numbers. Stanley was tricky. Once you got out onto the camp where the farms were, the Army and the Air Force people out there were just magnificent. And the relationships were very close. People got genuinely friendly, each helping the other. We could do things for them, they could do things for us in terms of fresh milk or whatever. Because one of the problems down there was getting fresh food. If we had mutton every day for 365 days of the year, sort of thing, because that was about all there was. So if somebody actually got hold of some fruit or a piece of lettuce, it was a red letter day.
What units then did you have out in camp? RAF units?
There were some, yes, the helicopter detachments. Some of them were out in the camp, as it was called. Then there was the radar stations, which were in the most inhospitable parts, right on the tops of the mountains, spread right across the Falklands. Then there were the army detachments, which would go out specifically, going across and checking the areas there. And because the interaction between the Army and the Air Force was so close, particularly use of our Chinook helicopters. Chinooks, what else do we have? Pumas, and then the Sea Kings as well down there, plus the Army Air Corps. We had a lot of aeroplanes.
Very busy.
Very busy, yes.
Mm. Yes.
So, and there was good flying down there, because I had a little Air Force. We used to run exercise and kept ourselves. Tragically, we had a couple of crashes down there, so my luck had run out as a boss. I've been fortunate enough not to have lost anybody when I was squadron commander or when I was a station commander. Combination of luck and some judgment, I think. But I ran out of luck down there. We lost a Phantom. The two guys were killed, sadly. They ran into a mountain. And a Harrier. A young chap killed himself by just getting too close to the ground on an exercise. Very easily done. And the latter was a classic. The visibility is so good down there that distances are very deceptive. And the vegetation is almost non-existent. The only thing there is scrub and bushes. And the bushes look as though they're trees. So because you tend to judge your height by looking at other things, if the average tree is, say, 80 feet high, 70 feet high, something like that, if you're about two or three times above, you're around about a couple of hundred feet. Well, these bushes were sort of 5 feet, 10 feet. And I'm absolutely sure this young man in the Harrier simply felt he was much higher than he was, and he just sadly... The other ones killed themselves, made the classic mistake of... there are very few hills around in the Falklands, but if you hit one, they're fairly hard. And he went into cloud, diving down to get out of the way of somebody who was coming in on him, I think. And unfortunately, he was not where he thought he was and went straight into the mountain. That was tragic, and I felt very saddened about that. And it raised a question about the workload on the people, because they literally were... We were on alert 24 hours a day. and the numbers of people we had to maintain that were not massive. And, you know, they would be on duty at night, and then they'd sleep down there, then they'd fly, then they'd be on duty again, and you, cumulative fatigue builds up. We don't realise it, but it does. And there's a strain, the operating strain out there was quite noticeable. I mean, I sensed it myself. I did quite a lot of flying down there. And operating off an old tin strip on a big, big aeroplane, which certainly wouldn't stop if you, you know, had a problem on takeoff, and then landing in some quite difficult weather where you really did need to engage the hook, was challenging, I think.
And did you... You obviously had boards of inquiry or something each
yes.
time you had these?
Yes, yes.
In order to ascertain the reason, or yeah. the likely reason.
Yeah, I mean, they were tragic. Both of them were pilot error. Yeah. But, you know, circumstances which sort of promoted that, I suppose.
And were you sent replacements?
Yes, we were.
So each time you yes. get a replacement?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And then you were on the Falklands for how long before you came back?
I came back at Christmas, just before Christmas, and I went off to the Royal College of Defence Studies and had a wonderful year there. It's the most marvellous place. It's a sabbatical year, but I think it's a brilliant year where you, you're selected, I think, as probably amongst the faster running members of your service to go there. So there's about eight. RAF 8, Navy 8, Army about, then Civil Service, Foreign Office, plus an equal number of foreigners overseas from all over the world. And I think they're sort of, you know, the combined intellectual capabilities are really quite marked. There were some very, very able people there. And it was a, you know, it was a joy to have a chance to mingle with them and to work with them, play with them. The work wasn't great, in the sense you could do it, you know, you were left to do it at your own devices. You had lots of lectures, projects which you did at your own speed. If you wanted to do them in the first week, you know, you got the rest of the summer off, sort of thing. A lot of travel, a lot of debates, very gentle pace of life, I think. But a huge, huge, certainly for most people like myself, who've been at it almost non-stop for, you know, some years. It was probably the sabbatical time that you needed to recharge the batteries. And I, for one, and it's still going, so I think probably I'm not alone in this, feel it was well worthwhile. The friends, colleagues, contacts that you make there are just priceless, because so many of those come up as the senior members of armed forces or senior diplomats around the world. And I've certainly had the benefit of going into certain countries and suddenly realising their old colleague was there, and doors are open which are just not open for other people. Yes. So I think the country gets actually pretty good value from it in terms of its door opening. And there's some wonderful stories about that around the world of you know, the alumni of the Royal College of Defence Studies letting military guys in where they won't let politicians.
And the overseas component included what one might describe as potential opponents as well as allies?
Well, in general, no. And I would think there were some one or two slightly shaky areas. But we didn't have any Argentinians on it, but I think they do now, which is good. Probably Far East, not too sure. I think not. I think in general terms, we obviously had, there was emphasis on NATO, there was an emphasis on our African and Empire Commonwealth connections, and then one or two, what I call funnies, which the Foreign Office thought was a particularly good idea to get alongside. It was very much a hearts and minds place. So I doubt if there were anywhere that we would say we're likely to be fighting them. On the other hand, there were places where it would be identified, and say the Foreign Office were the people who would do that, that relationships could be improved, and this was one way in which that might be done, and very often was. It is a great club, You go to India, for example, and the alumni of the Royal College of Defence Studies, you know, at one stage virtually ran India. You can see it. I went to a cocktail party in Delhi, where the great and the good were invited back from what was called Imperial Defence College, and I suddenly discovered it. These were the governors of the provinces. These were the people who were running the big industries. These were the chaps in government. Amazing, quite amazing to see the way the network had.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So after your year, your sabbatical year.
Yes. Yes.
You then went.
Well, what happened was I got promoted unusually, which I suppose was first signs that I was going along quite well, to Air Commodore halfway through. Normally, at the end of the year, you go to a job which gives you the opportunity to be promoted. But I was actually one star in the July that year, which was unusual. So, you know, I suppose my card had been marked a little bit by then. And at the end of the year, I was posted. Originally, I was posted back to the Ministry of Defence. But that was changed at the last minute. And I was sent to 11 Group, which was the fighter group, the one that had been responsible for me when I was station commander at Lucas. And I was the senior air staff officer there, working for a chap called Ken Hare, who'd been my AOC when I was station commander at Lucas and had been... I suspect he asked for me because he had certainly been, you know, as a man, as a New Zealander, but if you did your stuff by him, he supported you, and I'd obviously done right by him, so he'd given me some very good reports, I think. So I went to work for him, and then he left after a while, went off to Cyprus to be the commander of British forces, and a chap called Mike Steer came in. I worked for him for about 6 months. So I only had 18 months doing that job, which I have to say was like a duck to water. I mean, I knew the business so well, I could do it on, you know. And, yeah, I think I got it going quite well. My predecessor was a good chap, but I don't think he quite had my background in it, so I was able to wind a few things up and get it going, which was quite nice. And then, to my astonishment, they promoted me again and sent me off to SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, as the Assistant Chief of Staff Policy. Never heard of it. Never heard of it. What the hell is this all about? And actually, my primary job there was to oversee nuclear policy and the program, NATO program, by which I mean the nation's contribution to NATO in terms of their military programs, which we would set, and the infrastructure. It was a huge job. And the more I learned about it, that my predecessor was a chap called Benny Jackson, who I used to think was, you know, one of the best intellects in the Air Force, and indeed was. And I'd never aspired to be that sort of intellect. So it was a great challenge. But I was selected or at least recommended by Peter Harding, who was then the CNC Strike Command, who'd also been my AOC at my first AOC at Lucas, and I think I'd probably impressed him to a degree. And he selected me for that job, which one has to say was going to be the make or break, I guess, of one's career, because all my predecessors had been promoted out of that job to, I think all of them had made four-star things, so it really was a massive challenge. And off I went to it.
So this is a point, and I'm just looking back at my notes that I have here, that at about the age of 41, you really had to decide whether you were going to stay in the Air Force or not. And you made the decision to stay, as you've said, to stay until 55.
Yes.
So I just wonder, we know that they, I think you refer to it as Gloucester, said that, you know, we think quite highly of you.
Yeah.
We think we'd like you to go and do this, which is, in fact, the job with Admiral Lewin, I think.
Yes, yes.
Did you get any... It seems to me you're getting another indication that the air staff, or whoever it is, is going to wish you to stay all the way, and perhaps send you all the way. Was that apparent at the time, or
I think, or not? I think, well, firstly, being selected for Royal College of Defence Studies was an accolade. They, you know, you unless you really did make a cock of it, you were bound to make at least one star. Well, I did that halfway through the course, so yes. Quite clearly I was doing all right there. And then to be selected within 18 months of that, no, 2 years, less than 2 years, I was moved up the next rank to Air Vice Marshal. And I was then only 48, I think. So, you know, I'd gone from Group Captain to Air Vice Marshal from 40 in 5 years. Or less, really. I mean, I was a group captain I think I would have been a group captain in June 1984, and in June 1986 I was an acting Air Vice Marshal, confirmed in July. So in 2 years I'd gone from group captain, admittedly senior group captain, through to Air Vice Marshal. So I'd rush through, which does happen. So I wasn't... you know, the Air Commodore job, if you're really lucky and you hit all the right things and the job comes up, you can go through that in 2 years, although this day and age it's pretty unlikely. You know, jobs are few and far between. But nevertheless, it can